Welcome to the podcast of Sound Medicine, Public Radio's weekly magazine about medicine and health. I'm your host, Barbara Lewis. This free podcast is made possible by Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis, Indiana's premier urban health and life sciences campus, IUPUI, fulfilling the promise. I'm Barbara Lewis. This week, what makes us itch and how do we make it stop? We'll hear from someone who suffers from chronic itch.
Scratching didn't help, lotions, antihistamines, and after months of appointments with a slew of doctors, I realized they had no answers for me.
And two experts studying ways to treat it.
One part of the cortex might be telling you where the itch is. Another part of the cortex might be telling you, I don't like this, it feels awful.
There's no magic bullet, so it's not like other diseases where you take a pill and 90% of people who take it improve.
Plus, how much disclosure is enough? We'll talk about researchers.
How do we eliminate those unintentional psychological biases that might color your interpretation of the data?
And would you want to read your therapist's notes about you?
I have always tried to write my notes with the idea, what would the patient think if they read this?
Plus, of course, this week's stat and the checkup. That's all coming up next on Sound Medicine.
Sound Medicine is produced by WFYI in association with Indiana University and the IU School of Medicine and is presented in part by IUPUI, fulfilling the promise.
Welcome to Sound Medicine, Public Radio's weekly news magazine about medicine and health. I'm Barbara Lewis. We begin this week with the vexing question of itching. While it might be tempting to make a lot of lame puns about it, people who deal with pervasive itch assure us it is not funny at all.
An unpleasant sensation that creates a desire to scratch.
That's Dr. Brian Kim. He's doing research at the Center for the Study of Itch at Washington University. We'll be speaking with him later in the program. But to start us off, here's part of an essay that began our investigation into the topic of itching, written by contributor Nancy Calloway.
14 years ago, my face started itching. It spread to my hands and my arms and legs. Everywhere I had skin, I itched. It was constant, and when it got intense, I couldn't think of anything else. Scratching didn't help. Lotions, antihistamines, diet changes, all were useless. And after months of appointments with a slew of doctors, I realized they had no answers for me. 6 months later, my itching lessened, and some days it disappeared. But it always returned. Then, a year and a half ago, February of 2013, 13 years after my first big outbreak, the itching came back full-blown and constant. I again made the medical rounds. Between a neurologist, an oncologist, an internist, there were lots of guesses, from MS to a brain tumor or vital organ failure. So I had a CT scan, a brain MRI, and lots of blood work. Still, nothing.
We'll have more from Nancy's essay in just a while. So what is happening in the brain that triggers that itch sensation? Sound Medicine contributor Erica Barris reports on research underway at the University of Pittsburgh.
Poison ivy, bug bites, allergies. Just hearing those words can make you want to scratch. But even though we all itch and we all scratch, we don't know very much about what's happening in our brains when we do so. New work by researchers, including one in Pittsburgh, is attempting to figure it out. Sarah Ross is a physiologist and itch specialist at the University of Pittsburgh's Neurology Department and Pain Center. She says the neuroscience community has developed new tools that are allowing researchers to learn more about how neurocircuits work in ways that they haven't been able to do so before. And in recent years, funding agencies have pumped more money into itch-related research. That's helped researchers such as Ross, who are at the forefront of new sensory science.
We are interested in understanding how sensory information like hot, cold, itch, pain, how that information is detected on your skin and integrated in the spinal cord.
While the neural pathways of itch and pain are distinct from each other, they're also connected. They're like two sides of the same coin. Itch and pain are both alarm signals that warn our bodies that there could be something harming us. That's similar. But they're different because, well, they feel different, and they trigger different behavioral responses that may feel involuntary. So if you put your hand on a hot stove, your instinct would be to pull it away. But if something is triggering itch, the reflex is to scratch. Our nervous system is made up of billions of individual nerve cells, or neurons. They're wired together. Itch is first detected by nerve cells that have terminals in our skin. When they detect an itchy substance, they send that information to the spinal cord, which in turn sends it to the brain.
And once it gets to the brain, it goes to many different regions of the cortex. One part of the cortex might be telling you where the itch is. Another part of the cortex might be telling you, I don't like this, it feels awful. And then another part of the cortex, you know, part of your motor cortex might be saying, you know, let's get rid of this, I want to scratch it away.
That may sound like many steps, and it is, but it happens quickly.
From the moment that the sensory neuron detects the itch until you respond, could be very fast in the sense that the information passing from one neuron to another neuron, that's a millisecond process. And so even though there might be 10 neurons in the, 10 steps, each one is a millisecond, and so it's a very, very fast process.
What researchers don't yet know is why something causes you to scratch yourself. Ross and her colleagues are trying to figure out how the neurons are integrating that information and causing the scratch behavior. They're doing that using genetically engineered mice. They selectively label and manipulate groups of nerve cells in these mice to make certain nerve cells green and glow in the dark. These cells can be activated with drugs, allowing the scientists to trace the neural circuits and figure out how they do what they do.
We inhibit that one part of the neural circuit, and then we see, you know, do the mice still respond to an itchy substance? Do they still respond to a painful substance? Or, you know, now can they no longer respond?
They also use electrophysiology, a way of listening to the activity of particular nerve cells while researchers manipulate some aspect of the input.
We might record from a particular population of nerve cells that are the ones that respond to itch. And then if we added an itchy substance, we could hear those neurons firing much, much more rapidly.
They could listen for hours before hearing anything. Listening for sounds like this. Or it could sound like this.
We use very, very fine electrodes to just touch the very, very edge of the nerve cell membrane. And in that way, we can hear the electrical activity that's in the cell.
But what do these sounds mean?
We have a hypothesis that those itch neurons are conveying information through a particular kind of projection neuron. We could record from that particular kind of projection neuron and then test the hypothesis that if we add an itchy substance, those are the neurons that are going to respond.
Ross and her colleagues published a paper in the scientific journal Neuron, reporting that although it may not feel like it when you can't stop scratching yourself, the body often takes action to control itching. They identified a neuron that tries to stop itching by partially blocking the neural signal going from the itch site to the brain through the production of an opiate.
And what we discovered in this most recent paper is that those neurons function to inhibit itch. These are inhibitory neurons, and what they do is they block itch. And that's why when you lose those neurons, itch is abnormally high. And what we discovered about those cells was two important things. The first thing we discovered is that those are the neurons in the spinal cord that are normally releasing dynorphin, which is a kappa opioid. And kappa opioids, we show, inhibit itch, just like mu opioids like morphine inhibit pain. And so we think the kappa system is an endogenous system that is inhibits itch, and we're going to be able to use that to develop drugs that inhibit itch.
That's a good thing. While we all itch for lots of reasons, mosquito bites in the summer and wool sweaters in the winter are common ones, dermatitis or neuropathic itch can be a severe problem for lots of people. There are hundreds of disease conditions, including several mental health diagnoses associated with itch. Ross and her colleagues at Pitt aren't looking at that. They're looking at this from the bottom up. And as they move further into the nervous system, they hope to get to some of the other mysteries of itch.
And so if you are listening to this story and you're starting to feel itchy, it could be because I suggested it and I've been talking about it. Or if you see somebody else that's scratching, you might start scratching. That's because itch is contagious. We know that to be true, but we have no understanding of how that works. And there may be some diseases where that type of itch is heightened, but we don't understand that very well yet.
That could help, because after all, we all itch, and when we do, we all scratch. Reporting for Sound Medicine, I'm Erica Burris.
I'm Eric Metcalf, and today's Sound Medicine stat is 33. Selfie was the official word back in 2013. But more than a year later, going to beautiful locations and once-in-a-lifetime events, then taking a picture of yourself instead, is still very much a thing. But what happens when you start finding flaws in your favorite subject? Take pictures of someone else? Ugh, you have plastic surgery. Some people do anyway. A survey found that 1 in 3 plastic surgeons, what's that percentage-wise?
33.
Said they're getting more business from patients who don't like how they look in their selfies. This dissatisfaction may be linked to a recent rise in eyelid surgery, hair transplants, and nose jobs. Of course, if you don't want to make this kind of investment, you can download apps that whiten your teeth, darken your tan, remove blemishes, and even make your face thinner. You can look like someone completely different, but then, are you still taking a selfie? That was the number 33, and I'm Eric Metcalf.
Coming up a little later here on Sound Medicine, we'll look at the role the immune system plays in itching.
There's no magic bullet, so it's not like other diseases where you take a pill and 90% of people who take it improve.
But first, what's gained and perhaps lost when therapists allow patients to read their notes?
Okay, so you're not just writing a grocery list or anything while we're talking to you.
That's right.
Okay.
You're listening to Sound Medicine.
Health news headlines are presented in part by the Marion University College of Osteopathic Medicine in Indianapolis.
I'm Jill Dittmeyer with this week's health news headlines. Several new studies released this week show that the majority of women who have a lumpectomy for breast cancer may be getting more radiation treatments than needed. The conventional longer treatment lasts 5 to 7 weeks, but new findings show 3 to 4 weeks of more intense radiation is just as effective. That means less time for the patient and less cost for the provider. Healthcare.gov reported another 618,000 people had signed up for health insurance by midweek, and nearly half of whom did not have coverage before that. This week, Time magazine named the people who fight Ebola as its Person of the Year for 2014. Time cited their courage, focus, and willingness to risk their own lives to save others while the world tries to end the outbreak that has killed nearly 7,000 people this year. Two stories now about fears of new technology that haven't come true. First, the HPV vaccine, which guards against cervical cancer. Canadian researchers have found that young girls who get the vaccine do not engage in riskier sexual activity because they think they are better protected. The group followed 200,000 teen girls during 4 years of high school. Of those who had the vaccine, 6% became pregnant or contracted an STD. The vaccine has been available since 2006. And one concern about e-cigarettes has been that they might get more people hooked on nicotine if they're not worried about the cancer risk anymore. But the annual health survey in England suggests that might not be the case. Researchers found that only 1% of vapor cigarette smokers are former non-smokers. On the other hand, only 6% of conventional smokers have made the switch to vaping so far. Reporting for Sound Medicine News, I'm Jill Dittmeyer.
I'm Barbara Lewis. Two conversations now about transparency. In a moment, the implications of letting psychotherapy patients see what the therapists are writing about them. But first,
Medical journals require authors to reveal their financial interests in the subject of their research. So, for example, if a study about the health effects of sugary soft drinks is funded by Coca-Cola, that has to be disclosed. Then the conflict of interest rules expanded so that at times authors must reveal all of the funding sources for their work. Now the question in a recent JAMA article poses a new question. Should an author be required to disclose other conflicts that might color the outcome of the study? We asked Sound Medicine's bioethicist, Dr. Eric Meslin, to give us his thoughts. Eric, welcome back.
Thanks, Barb.
So what's the current rule for revealing conflict of interest?
The rule has actually been tightening up and getting more clear over the last few years. We've been worried about principally physicians and others in medical institutions who might be receiving gifts or have investments in the companies that they might be doing studies for. So the rules are now getting very clear how much money you can earn, what kind of relationship you can have with a company carrying out a study, whether your family is benefiting in any way, if you have shares or stock in a company that might be conducting a study. I can tell you that at every medical school in the United States, there are requirements for all the faculty to disclose upfront what kinds of honoraria they're receiving, what kinds of conferences they're speaking at, if they're paid consultants. So the rules are getting quite clear. In fact, we're rather proud that Indiana University is really getting a brand new policy together in probably 10 or 15 different areas. So lots of rules. That's not the issue. We've got more rules now than we ever have. Now we got to figure out how to apply them to some unique cases.
So in this Journal of the American Medical Association article, this author, Dr. David Shaw, talks about his personal experience. And he was wondering, right, you know, he was debating on a number of fronts when he should reveal conflict of interest. That goes beyond pay, obviously. I mean, in the paper he wrote for a medical law journal, he argued that adding fluoride to water systems is essentially giving a drug to the population without permission. But he has discolored teeth caused by too much fluoride, so he was debating whether he should disclose his personal feelings about fluoride in the water since his teeth were discolored by that as a child. I mean, does he need to disclose that? Is that conflict of interest?
Well, you know what I liked about this paper, and I obviously will put a link to it on the Sound Medicine website. It's called Beyond Conflicts of Interest, Disclosing Medical Biases. And therein, I think, lies the real issue, this line between a conflict of interest. And that is very legal and formal language. I have an interest in looking after patients. I also have an interest in making money from my investments. Those are pretty clear. But when I start to range into the area of my own medical information that might color my feelings about something I'm doing, that's what I think Professor Shaw is referring to, the medical biases that he might have. So his point, which I think has some merit, it's going to take a while for people to get their arms around it, is whether him having a particular bias against, say, fluoride, or maybe a bias in favor of a particular kind of medication. Bias because it's helped him. You know, I myself have migraines. Me, Eric Meslin, I have migraines. And if somebody asked me, would you like to evaluate a study looking at migraines, I could imagine being interested in that, not because I'm going to get paid for it, but I have more than just a passing scientific interest. I actually suffer from that very disease. So what I think Dr. Shaw is doing is drawing attention to those subtle psychological factors that inform decision making.
But wouldn't you say no to the study on migraines? I mean, wouldn't you feel like, well, I have this bias, so why would I tackle this topic in the first place?
Well, so therein lies the tale. I don't think it would be wrong for a person to participate in evaluating, assessing, and maybe even conducting a study when they have a bias. In fact, the entire system of medical science is based on trying to eliminate those biases that individual researchers might have. That's why we have double-blind studies, and that's why we have other committees assessing things. What's unique about this story is, where do you draw the line? you know, yeah, he might not like fluoride very much, and yet he himself has discolored teeth because he had too much fluoride. Does that disqualify him entirely? In the case of his paper, he said maybe he was pleased that he disclosed that because he wasn't sure if he could be objective. Other things, maybe less so.
Well, if you want to, this article, I mean, you could tell just how conflicted he gets throughout the whole thing, because he's talking about if you do a study about circumcision, whether it's harmful, well, do you have to reveal whether you're circumcised or not? Then he talked about a family member who had struggled breastfeeding. So, you know, do you disclose that? Is that a bias, even if it's not your own bias, but it's kind of a family bias?
Right. I mean, I think some of this boils down to two big issues. The first is, researchers are human beings. They have emotions, they have ideas, and yes, they have biases. Sometimes people go into an area of science because it was an area that affected them personally. They want to study diabetes because a family member suffered from it. That shouldn't disqualify them from wanting to be a diabetes researcher. In fact, it might make them more motivated and more committed to it. On the other hand, how do we eliminate those unintentional psychological biases that might color your interpretation of the data or that might color your study design? Those are the things that we have to be really, really careful about. I think he's written both an entertaining but also an important paper, because the line between conflict of interest and bias is a bit blurry at this point. We sure know what conflicts of interest are. We got lots of rules, but we don't have rules about what counts as how much medical information will disqualify me from even contributing to this study. So I think the world of ethics in medicine is concerned enough about this issue that no small journal, this is the Journal of the American Medical Association, arguably one of the top five medical journals in the world, is publishing a piece by a bioethicist that is drawing attention. So the proof is in the pudding of this paper.
Dr. Eric Meslin, thank you.
You're welcome.
Dr. Eric Meslin directs the Center for Bioethics at Indiana University. And now, a new exercise in transparency is underway in the mental health field. Previously on this program, we talked about the Open Notes Project, which gives patients access to the comments written by their physician during office visits. Now at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston, the psychiatric staff is taking that concept a step further by allowing mental health patients to access and read their therapist's notes. Dr. Michael Kahn is one of the psychiatrists taking part in that test program, and he joins me now. Welcome to Sound Medicine.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, we have been looking forward to this interview for a while, because I think the idea of reading your therapist's notes makes people fall into two clear categories. I mean, those who would love to read what the therapist is saying about them and others who would want to avoid it at all costs. In your experience, are you trying to record everything the patient or client says? I mean, when you're taking notes, what are you really doing?
Well, the notes are really a summary of treatment, not a detailed description of it. And this has always been true for treatment of all kinds. So what we do is not try to do an encyclopedic note, but rather just a fairly a synoptic summary that gives the basic points and the plans for the future treatment.
Okay, so you're not just writing a grocery list or anything while we're talking to you.
That's right.
Okay, all right. So you recently offered some support in the Journal of the American Medical Association for sharing therapy notes with your patients.
That's right.
Yeah, so how many of your colleagues agree with the practice?
Well, right now, all of my colleagues are doing it, and we have started a pilot project under the guidance of my colleague, Dr. Pamela Peck, where all of my colleagues in the psychiatric department are allowing a certain percentage of our patients to participate in that, and we are gradually stepping up the percentage and seeing how each step goes, seeing the reactions of both the clinicians and the patients to this new idea.
So how do the patients access the notes?
At our hospital, there is a secure website where the patients have long been able to access certain clinical data, such as lab reports or x-rays and so forth. And also, they've used it to contact their doctors if they participate in the website. Not all doctors do. So that's a pre-existing platform that we now use in order to allow them to access their psychiatry notes.
Okay, and Dr. Khan, then, so you see someone and they leave your office. When do you update the notes, and would they access those notes after every visit?
They certainly can. Ideally, we do the notes on the same day. Sometimes it takes a little bit longer. But those notes are either typed directly by the clinician into the medical record or transcribed very quickly from an oral recording that the clinician makes, which is what I do. And those recordings are transcribed within hours and put on the website and then are available for the patient to read.
So has it changed the way you make notes?
Me personally, very little, because I have always tried to write my notes with the idea, what would the patient think if they read this? I've always tried to make fairly patient-centric notes. For those clinicians who haven't done that, I think it does require a kind of a readjustment. For some clinicians who are used to using more jargon in their notes, there are certain jargon terms within medicine in general and psychiatry in particular that are often used to describe patient behavior that can have a more critical or pejorative or judgmental cast to them. And I think there are ways to describe behavior with more generous and accurate terms.
What are some of the arguments that people present against opening these therapy notes?
Typical reactions are it will upset patients too much. Patients won't understand what I'm writing. It will inhibit my communication with other providers because I'll have to use euphemisms or inaccurate terms. Things like that are common reactions.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Any validity to those criticisms?
Well, I don't think they're baseless, but I think some of the anxiety about patients' reactions being negative to be extremely unusual. Mm-hmm. And in fact, patients tend to really prefer the notes. And in fact, doctors tend to prefer them. There's been a lot of study done by my colleague, Dr. Delbanco, and Dr. Bell of non-psychiatric notes, notes written by patients' primary care doctors that have been revealed. And what they found is that after doing this for a while, that doctors really like it and prefer to do it with their patients.
Okay, so doctors really like it. Things are clearer?
Clearer, exactly.
Okay.
One of the difficulties in medicine is how to provide some kind of durable instructions to the patient once the session is over. And frequently we handwrite or type up some kind of directions to the patient because there's often a lot of information to be transmitted and it's more than anybody could remember. And so by having it written down in the record, if the patient is, for example, unsure of their medication dose, they can go right to the last note and check it.
We're exploring the question, should mental health patients be able to view their therapist's notes, with Dr. Michael Khan. He's a Harvard psychiatrist who supported the practice in a recent JAMA article.
I think everyone has gotten an email or gotten a text and they've just kind of misconstrued the meeting. You know, I mean,
yeah.
It isn't the same as being, you know, somebody reviewing where you hear the tone of the voice and the inflection and kind of the warmth. Is there a danger in that of the patient seeing the notes and really kind of taking offense because they don't really understand what's being said?
Well, this is a good point, and it's as my colleague Dr. Delbanco always stresses. You know, if we think of transparent notes as an intervention, just like we would a medication, for example, all medications can have side effects. Sometimes the side effects are rare, sometimes they're common, sometimes they're mild, sometimes they're serious. I think you're right that one of the side effects of doing this is the occasional misunderstanding or misconstruction of what the note said. And in those cases, it provides an opportunity for the patient, hopefully, to bring it back to their doctor and say, listen, what do you mean by this? Or I think you got it wrong, or you're overlooking something. And ideally, that provides an opportunity to cement the treatment relationship and also to clarify misunderstandings.
Okay, so you don't think that particular side effect, could be dangerous?
No, I don't.
Yeah.
Yeah, no.
Yeah. Let's talk through a few ways that reading these notes can be helpful to the individual. How can it reduce the stigma they may feel if they have a mental illness?
Patients are frequently, I've been impressed, frightened that they are quote-unquote crazy. This is the most common reaction that people have when they feel that their normal mental equilibrium is coming undone. And this is common for people who are not out of touch with reality, but people who are struggling with symptoms of anxiety or depression. And so frequently, they won't ask their doctor about it because they're afraid the answer is going to be yes, you are crazy. And so when you're able in a note to describe that, in fact, the patient is suffering from an anxiety disorder or depressive disorder or panic disorder, something like that, it tends to be actually very reassuring for the patient because they realize, I'm not crazy, I have a disorder, and this is the treatment for it. I'm not having a nervous breakdown, for example.
So how can reading these notes address denial or minimization that people either have a mental illness or might be grappling with addictions, for example?
Well, that's a very interesting question, and I think that to take the two common circumstances, one you mentioned is addiction. This is a topic that doctors and patients frequently tussle over, and some patients will readily acknowledge that they have a problem with addiction and many patients don't, and then there's a whole host of patients in between, of course. For those patients, it's interesting that the fact that something is actually written down that they can read and reflect on by themselves, not in an office with another person, can have a very powerful effect in terms of acknowledging something that can potentially be shaming, like an addiction. So patients can have the experience of saying, you know, I know Dr. Khan has been talking to me for months now about his belief that, you know, I'm overusing alcohol, and I've tended to blow him off. But, you know, now that I read what he's saying, and he does seem to mention a number of things that I've been having trouble with, you know, work and those speeding tickets and so on and so forth, maybe I really do have a problem with it. So it's sometimes easier to face something like that when you're alone and not under somebody's gaze. So that's addiction. The other more complicated one is people who really do have what we call a delusion or a fixed false belief. For example, that someone is trying to harm them or poison them or something like that, and which we find more in the illnesses like schizophrenia. There, the opportunity to use the what we call the agree-to-disagree intervention. For some patients, not all by any means, for some patients can be very powerful. In other words, one can say, you know, Mr. Smith and I continue to discuss his belief that his next-door neighbor is terminating treatment in a way that wouldn't be helpful for the patient.
Dr. Michael Khan is a psychiatrist at Harvard and Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. And he referred to the Open Notes Project led by Dr. Thomas DelBanco at Harvard. We'll post a link to two conversations we've had with Dr. DelBanco, both at the beginning of Open Notes and then later a progress report. It'll all be on our website. Just go to soundmedicine.org. It's time now for this week's Sound Medicine Checkup. Scientists in Germany believe they have developed the best methods to swallow pills. Jill Dittmeyer talks with an expert.
Swallowing seems like such a simple task, yet it's one of the trickiest for the body's nervous system.
We do it every day without even thinking about it, but it requires a bunch of voluntary and involuntary actions, and they have to occur in a precisely orchestrated sequence of about three different steps. So if you have a problem with any of those separate steps or phases, it can result in a swallowing problem.
Dr. Ella Bowman directs the Acute Care for Elders Consult Service at Eskenazi Hospital in Indianapolis, Indiana.
There are many situations where difficulty swallowing can occur, and some of them are pathologic or not normal, and some of them are actually just part of normal aging. As we get older in life, our salivary glands get a little lazy and secrete a little less saliva than they used to.
The German study gave 200 adult volunteers chalky tablets and capsules and offered them different ways to swallow them. Chalky tablets seemed to go down the easiest using the pop bottle method, a technique Dr. Bowman can't endorse.
Sticking a pill in my mouth and then immediately sucking in liquid through a bottle, I think could potentially, depending on the nature of the swallowing problem, I could see where maybe there might be a subset of patients helped by that, but I think that I wouldn't recommend that unless the patient were actually seen by an expert in swallowing.
That expert would be a speech therapist.
They go far beyond just swallowing. They actually can do cognitive assessments.
For capsules, the study recommends the lean-forward method that's similar to a technique she prescribes to her own patients called the chin tuck.
If you bend your head forward while you swallow, your epiglottis actually firmly sits down over top of your windpipe or trachea, and it is almost impossible to aspirate the contents of your mouth into your airway with your head in that position.
Dr. Bowman says keep it simple. Swallow one pill at a time and don't drink with hot liquids. And if your doctor says it's okay to crush the tablet, then take it that way.
But don't talk, laugh, eat, chew gum, do multiple tasks while you're taking your medicine. Pay attention to what you're doing.
Reporting for Sound Medicine, I'm Jill Dittmeyer. Yeah.
You can listen to Sound Medicine anytime by signing up for our free weekly podcast. It's at our website, soundmedicine.org. Plus, we're at Stitcher Radio, SoundCloud, Swell AM, and iTunes. Just search for Sound Medicine Radio Hour.
Sound Medicine is produced by WFYI in association with Indiana University and the IU School of Medicine, and is presented in part by IUPUI, fulfilling the promise.
Welcome back to Sound Medicine. I'm Barbara Lewis. Let's get back to our exploration of how and why we itch. Dr. Brian Kim is a researcher and clinician at the Center for the Study of Itch at Washington University. His work is focused on the role played by our body's immune system. Welcome to Sound Medicine.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you've recently joined the Center for the Study of Itch at Washington University. What a great name for a center. Tell us what your research focus is.
So the center is actually comprised of a number of investigators, and it's actually, there are a number of very, very kind of world-class neuroscientists at the center, and they've actually been in the business of kind of discovering new receptors that mediate itch. I came most recently, and I actually have a background in clinical dermatology as well as immunology. And what we've been actually working on, and my interest is understanding how inflammation in the skin can actually elicit or propagate itch. So I've been working with my colleagues in neuroscience to identify mechanisms by which immune cells may actually directly regulate the sensation in the nervous system. And we have a variety of ways we can do that by combining our expertise.
So you're really focusing, you said, on the immune system. I mean, a lot of your research, at least what you're most interested in at this
Absolutely.
Point?
Absolutely. Yeah, so there's this changing paradigm right now in immunology and other fields right now that a lot of things are caused by chronic inflammation. So not necessarily raging inflammation that we can see with our bare eyes, but that there is inflammation that's underlying a variety of different diseases. So there are people that think that, you know, chronic diseases that had nothing to do with the immune system previously, so we thought, are actually caused by chronic inflammation. A good example of that is heart disease, which was previously not thought to have anything to do with inflammation, and now it's appreciated that chronic inflammation may cause heart disease. In a similar manner, I'm approaching itch that way, and I think it makes a lot more sense in itch than even a lot of other diseases to look at the immune system first.
Have you ever worked with a patient who has, like, all over body itching?
Yes, frequently.
And that's something that, because it sounds like that would just be an absolute mystery.
It can be. You know, a lot of this is a mystery, but there are certain ways that we can manage it. And, you know, there are a number of patients that have itch on the majority of their body surface. In fact, I'd say that that's the majority of the patients that come to our itch clinic.
So if the cause of itching is a mystery, is there some agreement that some form of antihistamine, either a cream or a pill, can take care of most itches? Do we understand how that works?
No, So in fact, antihistamines, it's a good question because most people who itch will either take an antihistamine because they go and get Benadryl from the pharmacy, or even their doctor will prescribe it. And actually, most forms of itch, I would argue, are not adequately treated by antihistamines, and antihistamines are probably not very effective. part of the reason why histamine has become something that's very well recognized is, for one, there are a variety of antihistamines that were developed for other reasons, but also histamine was the first neurologic pathway that was identified that really distinguished itch as being a separate and distinct pathway and sensation from pain. Previous to that, it was thought that pain was simply a more extreme form of itch, or rather itch was a milder form of pain. But it's becoming very apparent now, based on research done by our center here at WashU and others, that that there are unique receptors and unique pathways that mediate itch.
Well, let's talk about chronic itch, you know, the kind that just won't go away with any sort of treatment. I mean, how common is that?
Very common. This is a poorly studied area in medicine, but anywhere from 10 to 15% of the population will experience chronic itch defined as more than 6 weeks at a time.
Can the cause of what maybe triggered it be pinpointed in chronic itch?
We hope so. We do have clues in certain forms of itch. There are patients with kidney disease or chronic kidney disease who develop itch. And if their kidney function improves, or if they get a kidney transplant, their itch can improve. This is also the case with patients with liver disease. In fact, their itch can be so bad, it can, in some cases of liver disease, can lead to actual liver transplant. And those patients will get better. Now, do we know what's causing it? Not necessarily, but we know that the dysfunction in those organs is a big culprit in that situation, but we don't know what molecules are causing that. There are other forms of chronic itch. For instance, a fairly recently recognized and becoming increasingly more recognized form of itch associated with aging. In that case, we have no idea what's causing it. We have some theories as to the skin changing over time and becoming thinner. So it really depends on what kind of chronic itch we're talking about. We have better clues for some, and we're completely in the dark with regard to others.
Okay, now how would skin getting thinner be something that would trigger an itch?
This is something that I see most commonly, I think, actually, in the clinic, is patients who actually come in and they've never had itch before. They don't really have liver failure or kidney disease that can precisely explain their itch. And they tell me they've never had this before, and I think that makes it even more debilitating because they don't really have coping mechanisms, and suddenly in their 70s and 80s, they're developing this chronic form of itch. But also in that population, we're well aware that there's thinning of the skin over time, and that's just a normal, I hesitate to say normal, but it is a normal process of aging. And your skin thins. This is widely appreciated among dermatologists. And the barrier gets worse, your skin gets drier. And that's really essentially what we think leads to eczema in its classical form. So in younger people who develop eczema, we think that dry skin and even genetic defects that lead to dry skin lead to eczema. So we now believe that patients who are elderly who are developing chronic itch, this is due to a barrier dysfunction. So the skin barrier becomes weakened over time. They're then sensitized to allergens in the environment that then result in an activation of their immune system that causes this form of itch.
So when we go back to chronic itch, not just among people whose skin, because of aging, is getting thinner, what has been the approach to helping these people in the past, and what seems to be working, if anything?
There are no FDA-approved drugs for chronic itch. So even antihistamines and other drugs were developed for other reasons that then we co-opted to treat itch. So a lot of times we use a variety of drugs with variable efficacy to treat itch because we as physicians and the patients themselves are quite desperate to find a solution. And if we're lucky, sometimes these other treatments will work, whether it's an antihistamine or we'll use other drugs even such as neuromodulators called gabapentin. We may even use topical steroids. You know, if we're lucky, we keep trying and we find something that works. So essentially, there's not really a systematic approach that's been outlined very clearly, although people who do treat itch have come up with algorithms. However, there's no magic bullet. So it's not like other forms of other diseases, such as high blood pressure, where you take a pill and 90% of people who take it improve over time.
Yeah, you mentioned sometimes you get lucky and the itch goes away. I mean, how often for people who have chronic itch does the itch go away?
You know, it's really hard to say because I can only speak from my own experience. It rarely completely goes away. However, what I do in the clinic is try to improve their itch to the point that it becomes manageable and they can live with it. Mm-hmm. And so it's really hard to put a number to it. I'd say it's almost never happens that someone's just simply cured. So it's, you know, it'd be on the order of at most 10%. However, if we do the right things, we try to treat the skin barrier, we treat with anti-inflammatories intermittently. There are ways that we can kind of tackle the itch and get it from, you know, a number 10 being the worst to zero being nothing, you know, bring it down to a 3.
If you're a patient with a chronic itch and that is your problem, I think a lot of doctors would say, okay, well, this is just like a symptom of something bigger. At the center, do you treat the itch itself as the problem?
Absolutely. So when we treat chronic itch, the first thing we have to do is find out what could be causing it. So we don't jump to the conclusion that it's just itch in and of itself, but we try to identify if there's something else that's going on, there's something wrong in the patient that could be causing the itch. And that could be, and that's why this field is rather complicated, because as I mentioned, it could be anything from liver failure to kidney failure to even having some kind of cancer to having just classical eczema. There are so many factors that can cause itch. So we try to take a systematic approach to eliminate all of those potential causes. And then in a lot of patients, actually in a not insignificant number of patients, we arrive at the conclusion that we can't identify what's causing the itch. In that case, what happens is that we have to treat the itch as a disease unto itself.
And I would imagine that would be extremely frustrating for the patient. You know, I mean, to get to that point and feel like, okay, finally.
It is frustrating. But to be honest with you, my experience with patients is that they haven't necessarily been told that. And I actually find that a lot of patients find comfort in realizing their itch is a disease, if that makes sense.
Well, Dr. Brian Kim, we'd love to check back with you and see how your research is going in the future. And thank you so much for your time today.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Dr. Brian Kim is an assistant professor of dermatology at Washington University Center for the Study of Itch.
I'm itching in the daytime, very itchy even at night. I'm itching until you call my name, then I know you treat me right. Got me itching and scratching, feel like a million bites. Itching in the morning, itching all through the night.
So, how did Nancy Calloway's search for her cause of her itch turn out? Well, after a circuitous route, she also ended up at the Center for the Study of Itch, trading emails with one of Dr. Kim's colleagues, Dr. Lynn Cornelius. Here's the conclusion of her story.
"Could I come to the clinic?" she wrote back. "And if I could wait a couple of months, another specialist would be visiting there, and they could evaluate me together." Well, when the day for the appointment came, I had high hopes. Dr. Cornelius and Dr. Martin Steinhoff from UC San Francisco began the exam. For the first time, I felt I was truly being heard. We covered a lot of the same territory I had gone over with other doctors, but there was a level of compassion for the pain I was in and a thoughtful effort to unravel its mystery. At the end of the exam, it seemed the treatments available were drug protocols. I'd been down that road. A couple of drugs I had already tried years ago had such bad side effects, I didn't know what was worse, the itching or the misery from the drugs. Thanking the doctors for their time, I mentioned I'd been in Europe for a few weeks and didn't have a single day of itching while I was there. But the day I got back home, the itching was up and running, all over my body again. Dr. Steinhoff smiled when I told him this. He said he had several patients who reported the same thing. Why would that happen? I asked. He shrugged and said maybe Europe is just cleaner, better food or water. They do care more about the environment there, he allowed. Then I guess I'm moving to Europe, I said. I've always dreamed of living in Paris. But I didn't pull up stakes and move to Europe, and by the end of last October, the itching was slowing down. And in a couple more weeks, I had whole days without any itching. Now, my cycle of mild to terrible symptoms persists. I am still waiting for someone to discover what the trigger is for my itching. My hope comes from knowing the research into chronic itch is broadening, and some good minds are finally focusing on this problem that affects millions. Maybe someday.
Nancy Calloway is an independent documentary filmmaker based in Indianapolis.
I'm itching for my baby and I don't know where to scratch. I'm keeping both hands busy on a one-man wrestling match. I'll never forget that first sweet kiss on the poison ivy patch. I'm itching for my baby and I don't know where to scratch. I'll not forget the time we met with love right from the start. Well, I took her strolling through the woods and there she won my heart. I carved her name up on a tree, a tall and friendly pine. And little did I know it hailed a poison ivy vine. Well, itching for my baby and I don't know where to scratch. I'm keeping both hands busy, I'm a one-man wrestling match. I'll never forget that first sweet kiss and the poison ivy patch. I'm itching for my baby and I don't know where to scratch.
And that's it for this week's program. Tell us what you think on Facebook or at our website, soundmedicine.org. And while you're there, you can subscribe to our free podcast. Sound Medicine's senior producer is Nora Hyatt. Eric Metcalf produces our interviews. Chris Lieber records and edits the program, and he chooses our music. Jen Burnham manages our website and social media. Steve Ali of Jazzville Studios wrote our theme music. Our executive producer is Eric Eggleton. Sound Medicine is a copyrighted 2014 production of the Indiana University Trustees and WFYI, Metropolitan Indianapolis Public Broadcasting Incorporated. All rights reserved. I'm Barbara Lewis, wishing you good health.
Sound Medicine is produced by WFYI in association with Indiana University and the IU School of Medicine, and is presented in part by IUPUI, fulfilling the promise.
Thanks for listening. For more information about anything you heard on this podcast, please go to our website, soundmedicine.org. I'm Barbara Lewis, wishing you good health.